Hey listeners, welcome to Trust in Tech, where we have conversations with folks helping the internet and society thrive. Today, we're excited to have Brandon Silverman, former CEO and co-founder of CrowdTangle, a social analytics tool that is used to help monitor public content in real time. He is now a policy expert for platform transparency, helping regulators, lawmakers, and advocacy groups think through the best ways to set up online transparency regimes. Here are some questions we answer on today's episode. What trade-offs exist for free speech versus transparency? How did CrowdTangle partner with civic actors across the world? Brandon's thoughts on the leaking of the Twitter algorithm? What principle CrowdTangle used when sharing access to governments? What metric did the CrowdTangle team optimize for? What Brandon wished he could have done differently at Meta? And of course, how you, the listener, can help in this fight for transparency. As a reminder, the views stated in this episode are not affiliated with any organization and only represent the views of the individuals. We hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
We both worked at startups in Facebook. It leads to a little bit of a different experience from the average Facebook employee. What do you think that difference was? And did it empower you? Did it make you lose any type of authority? How did that work?
Yeah, I think we definitely felt it for a handful of reasons. And I'll maybe divide it up between my experience as kind of like CEO, founder, and then being inside Facebook, but then also the difference between then the rest of my team. And maybe I'll start with my team. You know, the biggest concern, I think this is true for most companies that get bought, is kind of the single biggest concern is a culture fit. Is especially if you're at a startup where you had a good culture. And you know, the size we were at when we were bought, we were, you know, around 20 people. And if you're a startup that's doing well, there's kind of a magic spot around the 20 people where you all know each other. You're all kind of having to do a million different things, which means like you're learning a lot, but if you get the right magic, then it also is like, you know, not a lot of people have a lot of ego. And, you know, we would interview and basically ask people, are you willing to like do customer support along with all these other exciting things? So we were really trying to get that. But we had a culture that our team really appreciated and valued and was very nervous about losing. And when we got to Facebook, you know, I think there was some parts about the Facebook culture we found like we really learned a lot from and actually really loved. And then there were some other parts that were definitely kind of a learning curve to get used to. But I think probably the single biggest thing I saw with our team was that, you know, none of them applied to work at Facebook. And so there was definitely a disconnect between a lot of people who applied for a job at Facebook and were there on another team or parts of the company. And
so what does that disconnect look like?
Well, you know, honestly, I think it meant that sometimes they cared less about some of like the internal, you know, career opportunities that I think otherwise some people were, you know, and something totally reasonably very focused on like what were their, you know, performance reviews, what was like the next job opening and all these different things. And for our team, and it wasn't that they were, you know, disconnected from the larger company, but I think oftentimes there were moments when managers, teams, department heads would kind of assume certain things about the employees. And I think because our team had not actually ever applied to be there, wasn't always necessarily true. And, you know, and I, as to pivot over to me, like I worked very hard to make sure that that was never a problematic thing, but it was just like a dynamic that was different and unique. And it was part of like my job once I got there. And then for me, you know, I had never worked at a big company. And so, you know, from an intellectual standpoint, I was totally fascinated just to see what it was like to manage a company this big. And I mean, there were just very dumb things where I was like, I would ask about, you know, where you got certain resources and they'd be like, oh, you just go to that team. I was like, oh, that makes sense. There's a whole team that focuses on that. Great. But there were a bunch of things, you know, like Facebook's approach to management. They had this whole kind of 8 points management kind of like set of guidelines that I thought were like very well thought through and smart. And I ended up like adopting a handful of them in how I thought about management. So I think one, as somebody who'd always come from small companies, it was totally fascinating. There were a bunch of parts of the company that were just like very well run. But, and then I think trying to manage the culture was always one I was trying to figure out what that kind of integration look like?
I guess what do you mean by manage? There is a disconnect between culture, between the crowd, the sub CrowdTangle team, and like other Facebook employees. I mean, I experienced something similar when I was an intern. I guess in my case, I did apply to be at Facebook, but they just threw me in that specific team. And you definitely see this disconnect. Specifically, the top line metrics are like not as tied to Facebook's top line metrics, but it's like it'll roll up at some point to be somewhat relevant to Facebook, but it's not necessarily the team's goals. Also, the team's culture is slightly different. So like, for example, my team had remote work was like a thing before remote work became a thing.
Yeah, same everywhere, right?
So it's like, they're like, no meetings, we want to work remotely, we want to empower the individual. And those principles just didn't, I guess they just weren't as emphasized in the big company. So I guess like for you, like what were the principles that you were seeing stretched apart or that were juxtaposed between the small company atmosphere that you're trying to cultivate and what the big company was doing?
Yeah, well, maybe I'll answer a slightly different version of that, and then I'll get to that one. But just to make it very concrete, like I'll give two examples where I remember distinctly, like this is about us managing our culture fit. One was we had a kind of a very horizontal culture, and it was partly because we were so small and had product market fit. And so everything was just exploding. So we had to like over communicate with each other if we wanted to like function, and we were remote. So there were two things that we did when we got to Facebook, they didn't do. And there was a little bit of like, who's doing it right? And what's their approach? We used to do weekly wraps where we used to ask all of our partnership, our external facing people at the end of the week, just to write a wrap of basically like everyone they met with, like how it went, and a little bit of kind of like synopsis on like core themes they were hearing, you know, challenges, opportunities. And it was just a way for our team to stay on top of each other. There's some accountability, but everyone was running around so much that that wasn't even the core part of it. But it also, for me, it gave me the chance to kind of always have like a bird's eye view on what was happening. And when we got to Facebook, we met with the partnerships team and they just didn't do any communicating with each other. And so part of our team was like, well, does this mean we don't have to do wraps anymore? And I was like, no, I think we should convince them they should all be doing reps.
For sure.
So within like a few months, I think, you know, a lot of partnerships people were ultimately like, I get kind of annoyed that they now have this new thing, but a bunch of other teams adopted this strategy of kind of just being better asynchronous communicators with each other. And I think it really helped. And so I think it was a little bit of like us bringing some of our culture. But then a second example was there was a point in our tenure at the company when we wanted to change our mission. And we had been so used to being a horizontal team that, you know, there were very few times prior to getting bought by Facebook where, you know, myself or Matt, our co-founder, had ever just kind of like decided anything. We always brought our ideas to everybody. We talked them through. And, you know, at some point we would make a decision, but we usually got fairly close to consensus on like most things. And so when we wanted to change our mission, I was still very much that mentality, but our team had grown. It was probably maybe double the size. And so we had a retreat in New York. And at that point, there were maybe like 6 or 7 people who had joined us from other parts of Facebook. And so we got to the retreat. I said, hey, like I want to spend this retreat proposing like a whole new mission. And so like, here's my idea. Here's like some of the pros and cons I think would come with it. We're going to like break up into small groups and like dig into all of these and like come back and share them and see if we can, as a group, you know, see if we're feeling good about this and we think it's a horrible idea, in which case, like, we'll shelve it and, you know, go on. And we do this whole thing. And all of the Facebook people like pinged me after and were like, I've never done that before. Like, usually what happens is there's some executive level decision, like, hey, we're pivoting to e-commerce or we're doing this. And then the retreat is how to like implement that. And so this idea of like engaging everybody and thinking through strategy and tactics and vision and vision, I think was like not something that's usually as, you know, at startups, you're doing that constantly. Inside big companies, that's usually, you know, the job of leadership. but we tried to hold on to that for as long as we could. Now, I then had to take that mission and go see if I could get approval for it. But even engaging everybody on like what we should be doing here, I think was a unique experience. So it was really two I remember distinctly around culture.
So what was that? What was that pivot that you were trying to pitch internally?
So when we got bought, our mission was to essentially kind of serve the news industry and the publishing industry kind of as much as we could through like high quality data and analytic tools, and essentially to both help make their lives easier, but then also help them like thrive on platform as much as possible. But after being there for about 2 years, kind of two things happened. One is we kind of onboarded most of the major news partners around the world. So we kind of like got through the process of partnering and onboarding and training all of the like high level folks that we could identify, and not just high level, most of like the people we have on our list. But then on top of that, you know, after both like kind of what happened in Myanmar and Cambridge Analytica and some other places, like the external scrutiny on Facebook went from not zero, but like near zero for like a long time.
Yeah, we can talk about that later too.
Yeah,
for sure.
To like 100, right? And also, by the way, actually maybe a third thing also happened is Facebook increasingly, as Facebook expanded internationally, it became increasingly like a core part of like the civic ecosystems of like more and more countries. So by the time of like 2017, 2018, like external interest in what was happening on the platform was not only like becoming like a more popular topic among regulators and lawmakers, but like that data was becoming like really important to a lot of civil society. And so we just started to get inbound from a lot of different organizations outside of publishing who wanted some way to access our platform. So I eventually
like academics, journalists, basically, or sorry, academics, researchers.
So academics researchers were a huge part of it. And a big reason there is because following Cambridge Analytica, Facebook also like shut down a lot of the APIs that academics have been using. So not only was that data getting more valuable, but then they turned off a ton of the ways that used to be fairly easy to access. But no, it was becoming clear how important Facebook was to elections. So there were pro-democracy groups, there were election protection organizations, there were fact-checking groups. So in the developing world, there were human rights organizations, NGOs, there were IGOs, the UN.
And this is around like 2018 that they're showing interest?
I mean, it started to pick up in 2017, but like really reached like a fever pitch in 2018 and going into 2019.
Sorry, go ahead.
So we saw all this opportunity, and for a year we just had to tell all them no. And it wasn't just external organizations, it was also internal teams coming to us and saying, hey, can we give this to like our partners over here? They're really important partners for us. And so once it became clear that my team also thought it was an opportunity like they'd be excited about, I started going around internally to socialize the idea and see if we'd be allowed to do that. And we got the thumbs up. So
this pivot is pretty interesting, actually. Is you're partnering with not just media organizations, but NGOs, I guess governmental organizations as well.
As we went through this process, one thing we had to figure out was, you know, what were the new criteria for who can and can't get access? Yeah. And one of them was always very complicated was governments, because while we may have been excited about some governments who had like really public service oriented use cases that were really important, there were also a lot of bad actors that were governments or governmental agencies that we knew had a high likelihood of.
What did you do in that case, right? Like we had an episode with Turkey, like was it two episodes ago? And the gist was that Turkey had its own troll farm, government sanctioned troll farm or Russian disinformation campaigns. So what's it look like inside CrowdTangle at that point? What are you thinking about? What is the team thinking about when it comes to the trade-offs here?
Yeah, so we thought kind of blanket giving access to every government in the world was not the right approach to take. And so what we did was we actually said, no, the blanket rule, the core rule is that actually governments don't get access, but that there would be you know, opportunities for exceptions that, but in order to get an exception made, it had to be like on an agency by agency level. So it couldn't be for like the entire government of X. But if a particular agency at a government wanted to come and request access, our team and I could write up a proposal for a potential exception. It had to be a it had to be for like a finite amount of time. And that had to get approval from like, not all the way up, all the way high up, but like very high up. And so I think, you know, this isn't, there ultimately ended up being like very few times in which we thought that was worth it. And they tend to be around natural disasters. So gotcha. Can we help an agency dedicated to responding to a natural disaster help on the ground? And would it be helpful for them to,
So I guess how would the agency use CrowdTangle in the case of a natural disaster? Is it for coordinating disaster response, or how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give an example that I can talk about a non-one, but I think use it in a very representative way. Is we did a bunch of work with the Red Cross prior to getting acquired, and they would deal with it around hurricanes, floods, et cetera. And, you know, there were a handful of use cases that always stood out. So one is just kind of help them understand what was happening on the ground. Two, it helped them see what governmental accounts were posting and sharing. And so sometimes what might happen is like a local elected official might share some bad information involuntarily, and they could help flag that and correct and identify it. In other cases, it would help them figure out where to focus their efforts. So I remember there was, I'm not going to remember the exact hurricane, but the Red Cross is using it to literally help trying to inform where they should put, like where they should distribute extra water and food supplies and things like that. In some cases, it was as simple as like external influencers who were like offering to help, and they could just have an easier way to like see who those folks were and then ask them to reshare a particular public service announcement or something else. So yeah, there's actually a cool, one other one I can share is we have this video somewhere online, but there was a typhoon in the Philippines, and for like 9 days, it was kind of total chaos. I can't remember exactly the name of it. I don't remember the name. The type off the top of my head, but it was just a really big humanitarian crisis at the time. And the largest TV station in the Philippines, I don't know if it was ABS or somebody else, you know, for 9 nights, their evening broadcast had a CrowdTangle display in which they would like, they were seeing what was happening in real time, and sometimes they would talk about it, sometimes they'd reference it. And so it was like the backdrop to their evening broadcast for like the entire time, which our team did a lot of help with, but was just, you know, it felt good to know that we could contribute in some way to it.
Yeah, for sure. It's just it's why we do what we do, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I really want to know more about how else you partnered with these civic actors. For example, did like the Philippine agencies reach out to you? I know that you did work with, I'm not sure whether it was an agency in Myanmar or was it a nonprofit in Myanmar? I'm assuming it was regarding the Rohingya genocide. I know you worked with Sri Lanka as well with human rights activists. So what did that discourse look like? How are you creating those relationships, and how are you providing value to them to do their work?
Yeah. So there are a couple of things. So first of all, one of the things I really give Facebook credit for is for the 4 years we were there, you know, they invested in our team a lot. And so one important thing to note just around some of that, the work in the developing world and to these places, is that we had a lot of staff around the world. And so in Southeast Asia, you know, we had an office in Singapore, and we had people who went to Myanmar several times. I don't think they ever went to Sri Lanka, but we tried to spend time in some of these places with staff that we had on the ground in there. But there were, you know, there tended to be either two ways we got connected to a lot of those folks. Either one, in some cases, they were already Facebook partners and were doing some type of work with either the policy team or different folks and some sort of collaboration. And when I talk about that, because we got, one of them was a lot of those teams saying, hey, we would love to give this human rights group CrowdTangle, because right now they're able to like do this for us, but if we could give them this data, they could do even more. So one of them is, in some ways, some of them were Facebook partners to begin with. And in other cases, once we began expanding into academics, I think word began to spread. And I think a lot of them were kind of, a lot of people in those space who pay attention to the impact of social media on elections or rural violence or things, I think had known about CrowdTangle and were kind of eager to get it. And in some cases had applied like many times in the past. So it didn't take a lot of outreach on our part at all. But, you know, once we started working with them, you know, in some cases, some of the human rights activists are kind of public figures that are known. Others, it's a lot more sensitive given where they live and the dynamics around, you know, being targeted by the government or pro-government forces. So it's always a little, you know, nuanced in both who they are and how to talk about them. But in all cases, they were, you know, essentially we were able to give them access to some public data. And, you know, one of the things they would do is, and probably the most high profile example of this is Maria Ressa in the Philippines, is they oftentimes have so much in-depth knowledge of where they live and the local nuances of like hashtags, and they can sniff out if like suddenly this page that's gotten really big in the last 6 months and is mostly talking about X, but whenever they mention politics, it seems to have a very pro-governmental like slant to it, or, you know, like they're just so much more informed about the local nuances of where they are that they can flag a lot of malicious use cases and bad actors a lot faster than teams that aren't based in the area. So, you know, Maria Ressa and Rappler in the Philippines, she identified what Facebook calls coordinated inauthentic behavior, which is when the Duterte government was literally creating fake accounts, masquerading at either other fake people or fake entities that were like very pro-government. And they were literally run by the military, but they pretended not to be the military. And her team was so in deep in like the politics of the country, including a lot of those networks, by the way, were like targeting her and harassing her, that she was able to figure out that these were coordinated inauthentic networks. They were direct violations of Facebook's policies, but they just hadn't been caught. She was able to flag them for a Facebook policy team in a way where they then went into the normal review process and they ended up getting taken down. And if she and somebody locally hadn't done that, it's very unclear when and if those accounts would have been caught or removed at all.
So she's using CrowdTangle with her regional nuance to understand the environment.
Exactly. Yep. Okay. And that was honestly, that exact use case is, I think, one of the things that red-pilled me on transparency, which was some of these platforms are so big and they are so deep in so many unique, disparate, heterogeneous communities that being able to navigate and understand the nuances of all of them around the world, I think, is essentially impossible.
Mm, right.
And one of the few imperfect ways I think you can deal with that is to allow local communities some degree of ability to participate in the governance of those spaces. And I think one way you can do that is by making it easier for them to just see what's happening on them.
Yeah.
And so opening it up for local civil society, local academics, researchers, nonprofits, journalists in a community to have a easier, better window into what that digital ecosystem looked like in their world, I think it's just like I don't want to say table stakes because I don't want, like, it's, but it is one of the ways you, I think, address the impossible scale of some of these platforms. And we had an example after example of like what that looked like, whether it's Maria in Philippines or people in Sri Lanka or Ethiopia or Nigeria or all these places where we know they don't have the content moderation that they deserve, quite frankly.
So these actors would like flag, use CrowdTangle to do their own self-moderation. Is that the,
yeah.
And then they would flag it to Facebook, or they would flag and like open up a task. Like how exactly would that work? If it's content moderation, their own basis.
Yeah. So actually there's a bunch of things you do. So it is, in some cases you flag it because you say, hey, this is violating content. Like Facebook, you should take it down.
Yeah.
In some cases, it might not be violating, but simply knowing it's happening, they can then respond with their own like public campaigns to counter a message that might be like misleading or, disagree with. And so they're simply saying, hey, we noticed that there's this like organic campaign being run to that says X and we disagree with X. So now that we know how big it is on social, we're going to counter it with Y. Or ideally, you can even get to it as it's like still beginning to grow. And then third is in some cases it's illegal. And so what they might also do is flag it for like local governments. Now, obviously, if you are like somewhere where the local government is the one propagating the illegal stuff, that doesn't work. Yeah. But in other cases, you know, there were places where there were, you know, very legitimate liberal in the like philosophical sense governments. And but like having local people who understood the dynamics of their ecosystems really well, they could find illegal harassing content that might be like, you know, targeting or dehumanizing marginalized communities and people, or like triggering real world violence that otherwise just weren't being caught. So I think you can actually do a bunch of things. It's not just doing Facebook's work for it. It's like, it's a wide variety of things, but you can't do any of that if it's all just in a black box.
Right. So I think there's a couple of ways we can go off of this. One is, yeah, I think what you mentioned about transparency, essentially what it is, right? It's a philosopher king at the helm, with no accountability metrics, there's no window into it. And we don't even let our government run like that. So why should we let a platform with 4 billion people, 5 billion people run like that, like the Wild West, right? And I think at some point, the scale necessitates transparency. And I think that's what you're seeing with the DSA. And obviously, I'm not telling you, you already know all of this for sure. But I think this is a good segue into what you're defining as transparency and what you're seeing the challenges look like from like a regulatory perspective. The GDPR came. I worked on getting our things compliant to the GDPR, and it was a pain in the ass. I remember there were some simple metrics we couldn't use, such as just counting basically how many violations someone had. And obviously we had to change the counting metrics to something that was more compliant. Then we saw like content moderation get worse because we lost some signals of like a feature trained on message data. And specifically in the case of e-commerce, I worked on Facebook Marketplace. So specifically in the case of e-commerce, they'll make a listing on like selling a gun on Marketplace, but instead of a gun, it's a gun case. And they'll just like, please DM me for details. And you really can't know what's going on unless you look at the messages. But even in that case, there can be a differential privacy way of training the messages without leaking the user data. So I think there's this tension between transparency and privacy, and there's a regulatory perspective. And we can go on both, whichever one you want to hit first.
Yeah. No, I mean, listen, I think the reality is like transparency absolutely comes with some trade-offs in some other spaces. And I mean, this is a nerdy podcast, so I'm going to nerd out a little bit.
Oh, 100%, please.
All right. So I've gone very deep on a lot of the regulatory.
As context, approaches. Brandon has rolled up his sleeves.
do I look more excited? So I've gone very deep over like last year and a half on a bunch of regulatory approaches to transparency. And, you know, I thought they were complicated before. I think they're even more complicated now, but you know, I'll go through what I think are the two biggest challenges. So in Europe, it's GDPR. And GDPR is massive privacy bill, passed in Europe. But it's very limited on what it allows you to do with user data at all. Even if it might be that particular use cases of user data are in the public interest, there are parts of GDPR where if you read it literally and very narrowly, even doing things in the public interest that is not specifically proscriptively, you know, defined through GDPR is against it. And so you have to, it's just been very complicated and nuanced to figure out how you create any transparency mechanisms that don't violate GDPR. And by the way, even if you get outside GDPR, there's a cohort of the privacy community where anytime you talk about transparency bills, they're for it, but their kind of first principle is these platforms should be collecting way less data. And any regulation that requires them to share it is going to entrench the fact that they have it at all. Right. And our whole goal is that they shouldn't even have it, let alone like safely sharing it. And, you know, I think there are some totally reasonable like points of view to that, but I also think we have to find some balance. But so that's Europe. I think in the US, and I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but through a lot of conversations, a lot of reading and work I've done, like the First Amendment is a real challenge to transparency regulation of the US. But maybe I should be very clear. The First Amendment as interpreted by the current Supreme Court. And gotcha. To give the very quick like 30 seconds on this is following Citizens United, we corporations are afforded the same constitutional protections as people, including the First Amendment. The First Amendment protects your ability both to speak, but also not to speak. And if you are requiring private companies to give you data, that is the equivalent of them talking. And so you have to either make the case that it is overwhelmingly in the public interest that they should be forced to speak, which would be like a violation of the First Amendment not to, or that you can prove it falls in more of the realm of disclosures, which is like they're not speaking new things. They already have this data. They've already collected it. So they're in some ways kind of already said it. They just haven't said it publicly or to the right audience. And so in a lot of the legislation, what you do is see some like work around how do you create this in such a way where it's had least likelihood of being overturned on First Amendment grounds.
We can get concrete with this. So what's an example piece of legislation that a First Amendment absolutist would be viscerally annoyed by, but a transparency advocate would say, please, we need this. And then in the long run, it will help the First Amendment for, I don't know, citizens.
Yeah, I mean, so I helped write something called the Platform Accountability and Transparency Act. It was introduced in the Senate, the bipartisan group of senators last session. I think it's not public, but it actually has some more high profile Republicans who've just signed on it recently, including Mitt Romney and some others. So it's going to be introduced with an even more bipartisan group of senators fairly soon. But there are some constitutional First Amendment lawyers who would say that there are pieces of it that they're unclear if it would hold up in court. Now, I think myself, and I'm not a lawyer, but there are lawyers who are involved in the crafting of it, I think have the arguments they feel confident in about why it would. But I think their one argument they would make is that if social media platforms are publishers, there is a jurisdictional history among the First Amendment that if you force a publisher to disclose decisions around their editorial practices, that would very easily translate into pressure and governments being able to pressure those editorial decisions in a way that violates their First Amendment.
Interesting.
And if you want to read more about this, there's a professor named Eric Goldman who's written several papers about this. But in this case, the concern is by forcing a publisher or a newspaper to be transparent about why they're making their decisions, that would inevitably lead to external pressure on those decisions that would shape. So it's like, it's why we don't demand that the Washington Post have their editorial meetings out in the open all these different things. And that, you know, that it's a free speech issue. Anybody can get up and say whatever they want and they don't have to disclose anything about it. So that's the far end. That being said, I would, you know, like I believe in the First Amendment too. And I think when you read, there are other experts who I think would make other arguments about why it's not. And I think the one that, again, not to get too in the weeds, but I think the most compelling one.
We can get too in the weeds. Go for it.
All right, great. This is a constitutional law 101, or maybe we're 201 at this point.
It has to be 4,000 level or it doesn't make the cut.
Great. So I think, I mean, this is what I've actually spent a lot of my time doing over the last year and a half, but I think there was a paper written by Daphne Keller maybe like a month and a half ago in which she talks through the jurisprudential history of First Amendment and public disclosures and what it might mean for social media platforms. And her final point, one of her final points in it, is basically her looking at whether what the grounds you would actually rest this on is around democratic self-governance. That if a entity has become so critical to essentially like the body politic of the country, that having it be a black box interferes with the public's ability to participate in like political processes and democratic discourse and elections and, you know, all these things.
Would you say a publisher also can fall within that purview?
It could. So the difference here is, so on one hand, Eric Goldman's argument, and again, I'm some constitutional lawyer out there, I'm sure is like heads exploding about how poorly I'm summarizing all this. So I think the Eric Goldman standpoint would be like, if you're going to hang your hat on the publisher side of things, then the jurisprudential history is like, doesn't look good for you.
Gotcha.
And Daphne is saying, this isn't about publishers. This is about entities that become like critical to the democratic self-governance of the country. And that there are some papers that have like gotten big, but like not so big that if like they went away, the country's like democracy would fold, or they represented like threats to it. And I think in this case, she would say though, I think part of the argument is like, if the vast majority of Americans are getting their news from Facebook or from social media, period, like that's become like a critical part of the infrastructure of like the democracy of the country. So there should be a different set of First Amendment standards there than there are for like, can I force my local town paper to disclose, you know, their editorial board meetings.
Yeah, I mean, I guess like I just don't really believe in the publisher analogy to begin with. There's a couple of reasons why. Yeah. So first off, publishers have an agenda that they're trying to propagate. Social media doesn't particularly have an agenda besides maximize engagement, sell ads. And then another one is publishers are not a space. They're not somewhere where someone will spend time. It's a one-way relationship. Whereas platforms are a space where people interact with others. I would push back on that a little bit.
I mean, I think there are absolutely some newspapers out there that like they would describe themselves as communities and community organizers and community builders. Mm-hmm. And their goal is not just to get people on their website, but to get people out to events and participating in comments and things like that. So I think there's some history in newspapers of absolutely being more than just like one way relationships.
I agree to that generally speaking, but where I kind of fall is that these analogies, which generally are predicated on common law, just fail when it comes to big tech. So one is for antitrust stuff. Like Apple shouldn't be allowed to make Android text green, but you'll never get a consensus on that. And it's because it doesn't fall within the purview of a normal antitrust situation. Yeah. It's not Rockefeller, it's not Carnegie. And whether we should have evolving terms, I'm not sure what the solution is there. I just don't believe these analogies are constructive in that way. And so that's one part. And then the other part where you said the communities where these publishers have communities with them. I mean, like, sure. But at the same time, their community isn't 4 billion people. So I think the scale is where you get lost there. Yeah. Not that I'm disagreeing with you, but again, this podcast, we're just discussing things.
So. Yeah, totally. Well, it's funny. Yeah, I think where the analogy breaks down for me is actually on the other side of it, which is I think we've been like, I think one challenge with the entire discourse around social media has been the degree to which like we treat it as like this monolithic thing. Whereas like the design affordances of like Twitter are like vastly different than Facebook. And because they have like a vertical feed, we like treat them all like social. Like I think if Tinder and Grindr and dating apps and have like vertical feeds instead of horizontal swiping, it would have like might have stopped this entire discourse around social media.
Interesting. Okay.
Well, because like what is actually similar? They're user generated, you know, spaces that have like a vertical ranked feed, but like, you know, Twitter is not social. Twitter is barely social. YouTube is essentially not social at all. Yeah. The only thing social about YouTube is when YouTube gets shared on Facebook. I think social media has been a very misleading term we've thrown around. So I actually think on the other side of the analogy, it's just this mix mash of different vertical based, you know, feeds that unclear how much they all have in common with each other at all.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Twitter, right? I think it's a good segue into asking what you think about Twitter disclosing its ranking algorithm. That's a form of transparency, right?
So I think the most important thing about Twitter disclosing its open source algorithm is, so they did it on, I'm going to try and get the dates right. I think it was like April 3rd or something. Or it was April 8th. It was like a Friday. The Wednesday of that week, they had also done something that I think is actually vastly more significant when it comes to transparency, which was they had announced the final pricing of their APIs, which includes all of the APIs they used to make available to academics and researchers, which used to be free.
Yeah.
On Wednesday of that week, they announced that it was going to cost at least starting at $20,000 a month, I believe the number, and ranging up to like $700,000 a month. And by the way, at the highest point, it would also only be, I think it was 1/8 of like what academics used to get for free. And by the way, like Twitter was historically the best data sharing platform of all of, you know, quote unquote, social media.
Honestly, that was really good for research. But if you look at like research papers and you're like, social media does this, it's always Twitter based.
Totally. 100%. And
kind of pissed me off because it's like, I'm not. Yeah. I mean, I think Twitter is a completely different medium than TikTok.
100%. I think the whole community would agree with this is like, because it was the only data source, everyone like tried to answer all the questions with it. And they would oftentimes just like way out past their skis on like, what that data could even ever show. But like, it was the only game in town. And so everybody was trying to use it because it was the only option they had. And in some cases, like you could imagine if it getting priced like pricing it isn't the most unreasonable thing in the world, and maybe it would address some of that, but they set the price point so high that essentially it destroyed and like killed all academic research into Twitter. And by the way, one really important note about this is when you cut off like research and visibility into Twitter, Twitter at its best is essentially like a chat room for the open web, where you take like publicly available URLs and you post them and talk about them. Mm-hmm. And so not only are you killing visibility into Twitter, you're also cutting off a huge amount of visibility into the rest of the open web as well. So anyway, so that in my mind was so much, I mean, there, I was on a chain of researchers who were all using this data, and they're like, there's no feasible replacement for this. This project is going to die. And they had gotten funding and hired people and all those things. And by the way, let's not even talk about the shitty nature of the process. They didn't give them the normal, like, we're going to deprecate it in X months and we're going to go request, you know, it was a very just like capricious process. But that research is all just dead now and it's gone. And while I want to remain like optimistic about any transparency efforts I see, including something like open sourcing algorithm, which nobody else has done, I think the fact that it was paired with such a dramatic and much more significant step backward makes it hard to like give them too much credit. And then I was, you know,
I mean, I don't want to give credit at all. I just want to know what you think of it.
Yeah. Well, so I mean, so in terms of the algorithm itself, unfortunately, I think the reality is that like there were just too many missing pieces that were not included. So they didn't open source the algorithm. They open sourced a few parts of the algorithm.
Okay.
And the parts that were missing were in some ways the most important parts. And I think you can go, and there are other people who, you know, there were people who worked on Twitter's ranking who commented on this. They're like, yeah, the most important parts are not in here. And by the way, ever since Elon proposed this idea, we knew that those missing parts would never be exposed, because you can't expose them without sharing privacy data, or because it like deeply shares some like very, you know, proprietary business approaches or different things. And so
what were those missing parts? And then why would they compromise privacy?
There's a few posts I encourage people to read. They're like Solomon Messing is a former data scientist, also a former data scientist. And he went through the nuances of this. There's a Princeton professor. So I can maybe in show notes, we can put
show notes. We can link all of this for sure.
Really? But if you basically just look at how ranking systems work, this just took a small slice, which was, what do you do with engagement-based stuff? And I even think all that, it was only engagement-based stuff on people you follow, I think. And what it doesn't do is combine it with what the system knows about every single individual user and what their preferences and history show. So it is not simply that if anybody tweets a tweet and it gets 10 shares and 5 comments and 3 this and 3 downranks, therefore, for Brandon, it'll show it to him in spot number 6. It also combines it with my entire history on what the system knows about me and what I'm likely to respond to. And it does not include any of that. And it's because that's very hard to do. It's hard to do without exposing some of my preferences. It's hard to aggregate en masse. And it ends up, and that, I think, modeling for what each individual user is likely to respond to is the bulk of what ranking actually happens. So gotcha, I was trying to imagine it's like you're creating a stew.
Right.
And, you know, at the very least, you know, there's going to be some potatoes and like cumin in there. Mm-hmm. And so what they released is exactly how much potatoes and how much cumin they put in the stew.
Right.
But they're not telling you anything else about it, because doing that would expose the type of stew Brandon likes to eat, and they can't do that. And so all you know is there's some cumin and potato in there, but you have no idea what else is in there. I don't know if that analogy works. I hope smarter people listening to this podcast can tell me if it doesn't or not. But
no, our audience is very smart. I like to think they're all smarter than me, which is probably true too. But anyways,
I'll throw one very last thing on the algorithm. Heuristic I also use is, and how to measure meaningful transparency is, did it lead to any like significantly new or deeper or more robust understanding, and did it lead to any sort of policy impact or change? I saw some like hot takes spreading around on Twitter around like, oh, this and that. And so it wasn't zero, but I don't think it like deeply, you know, lifted the curtain on how the system works in a way where I think Elon would have imagined. But I do think that what it also did do is one of my favorite parts of transparency, which is what I call the educating the bosses point of transparency. which is there are lots of things about these systems that the bosses don't know because they're busy and they have a lot of stuff on their plate. And that sometimes the transparency will actually make them realize parts of it they were never aware of. And again,
who are the bosses in this case? Like bosses of integrity? So in this case,
there are multiple things that Elon seemed to reply saying, I had no idea that was the case. We're fixing it. So like somebody had written into there a very specific set of like scores and for the Elon rules. And I'm sure, you know, Elon demanded something relative to that. If I'm attempting to give him as much credit as possible, which I'm not sure he's earned at this point, but like, is that he imagined the system holistically being better at X or Y in a way that would be reflected on his account. But instead, yeah, somebody just went in there and said, no, we're just, if it's Elon's, do this. And when he saw that, he at least, again, just for the sake of thought experiment here, we're assuming he was being in good faith when he said, I had no idea that was the case. We're fixing it right away. I saw that similar dynamic happen in different parts of CrowdTangle and other things, which is like sometimes the public transparency actually makes bosses realizing things about the dynamics of their systems they didn't know before and were maybe hard to get their attention on.
Yeah, I think the bosses thing is interesting because I remember I was perusing through our code and sometimes the integrity stuff touches each other whenever you're lucky, it's centralized enough. And I saw this like weird enum. I don't even know if that's what it was. It was like a weird page where it was like presidential exception. And I was like, I probably shouldn't go deep into that one. But then I was just like this. And then the Elon rule reminded me of that. I was like, ah, been there, done that, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, for sure. I also wanted to ask you about, actually, while we're on transparency, I also wanted to talk about what you would have done differently than Elon in terms of, or than Twitter. Because you said there is this trade-off, right, between the algorithm, putting this algorithm online and like losing, like users are not, right? So do you put like the user taxonomy online too? Not for each user, but do you aggregate for like at least like 1,000 people? This is the lookalike group, and this lookalike group would have worked with the, I would have intersected with a algorithm like this, and this is the average score of this lookalike group, like a data trust thing where like the trust is greater than, I don't know, 20,000-30,000 people, where it's big enough where it's privacy compliant but small enough where it's a meaningful niche. I guess my question is, how do you do that differently?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give a very simple answer to this question. It's just, I would have done what they were doing before he got there. There were two teams in particular, UL Roth and his team and Hillary Ross were running something like the Twitter moderation and research council, some version of that. But they were basically a team that was helping share data with outside researchers and academics and also thinking really thoughtfully about how to even give data to the rest of civil society, to journalists and academics and human rights groups, et cetera. And, you know, for months they had done this consultation where they tried to figure out exactly the vetting procedures. And it was, you know, they were just a very thoughtful team that was really trying to make as much data as possible accessible to the outside world. And then secondly, there was a AI ethics and research team run by Raman Chowdhury and a handful of others, like a super impressive team she had built over there. They were also doing deeper dives into more privacy-sensitive data my brain always stops it, but they've been using what they call privacy-enhancing technologies and have partnered with a few outside organizations to like do synthetic data experiments and all these different things. But we're just like, again, like really like industry-leading, thoughtful, super brilliant people trying to do all this work to support transparency. They had also, you know, one of the things I also really respect about them, and people who know my story will probably know why this resonates, but they had done some research into the Twitter feed, into the degree to which the algorithm might be rewarding kind of like right-wing voices versus left-wing voices. And they had found that the algorithm was having a disproportionately positive impact on right-wing voices. And when they found that, they published it. And they said, hey, we recently discovered this, and we're going to like publish these results online. And we're going to like partner with some external groups to like, because we're not really sure why. And so we're going to like try and partner with some outside people to figure out why. And it was, so they were both like, you know, they were both pushing and making transparency like much like they were pushing the boundaries of transparency, but also being very transparent themselves. So those two themes I thought very highly of and were doing awesome, great work. And Of course, all those people are no longer at Twitter. Those teams and projects are all dead or no longer, you know, or at least nobody's talked about them at least in 6 months, although some of them are definitely already dead. So I would have, you know, I would have done what Twitter was doing. They were doing great work.
But what's a concrete, tangible project that was coming out of their work? What's like a policy proposal or like a tech proposal that was coming out of that work that would be different than Elon's algorithm leak?
Well, so some of it is, I mean, I think when you, the data that was being made available was having a bunch of like real world impacts.
Okay, gotcha.
Some of it was just about constantly monitoring the Twitter ecosystem, because all these ecosystems are changing constantly. They're kind of having new malicious actors attacking them from different vectors. The politics of the different places they're interchanging. Like, so one is just the ability for the outside world to follow what's happening on the platform at any given time. And so right now, for instance, there's a very, Elon is loves to have a debate with outside people about how much hate speech there is on the platform.
Right.
And right now it's essentially impossible for the outside world to verify it. And so he gets to just say it's at historic lows or whatever he is. Mm-hmm. And there's nobody who can say whether that's true or not. In the previous, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, there would have been a whole entire community of external researchers who could have pointed you to a bunch of different papers and research they were doing to, you know, provide different metrics and, you know, thoughts on it. So I think one is just like, what's the current state of the platform? And is there anybody on the outside who can verify anything Elon is saying? And the answer now is no. And then secondly, you know, I also think per the point of like Twitter being a chat room for the web is, which by the way, I think I first heard that from Ryan Broderick at Garbage Day, which is a Substack everyone should go read. It's my, one of my favorite Substacks. Yeah, I think we've lost a lot of visibility into how the outside world is using it. And, you know, for instance, like my anecdotal observation at this point is that Twitter seems to be was full of a lot of crypto people for a while and now has a lot of AI people.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just my feed, but I don't, but I think maybe my suspicion is that with smaller integrity and trust and safety teams at Twitter, that a lot more marketing spam is making its way onto the platform, which is always like the first set of malicious actors to go after an unguarded piece of real estate. And so
Can you say that in different words so I can understand?
You're an integrity worker and you have a new valuable piece of digital real estate, like a Twitter or a Facebook or anything. I think, you know, most integrity teams spend most of their time trying to stop spam and marketing bad actors.
Right.
Versus like political or other types. And it's just because there's money to be made. And if you look a lot of like the trends among like bad actors and malicious use cases, they tend to follow just like spam trends over time.
Okay, I see. Yeah, for sure.
So it's just to say that like when I look at all of the crypto and AI stuff, to me it feels like a slightly legitimate version of spam and like marketing bad actors that are just increasingly taking over the platform from my point of view. But I have no ability, no outside ability to look at the platform, I can't tell if it's just my ranking or the rest of it. But
I guess it's a good way to A/B test your ranking versus sanity check your ranking between what the general public thinks and your particular bubble.
Yeah. Although that was always, tell me if this resonates with you at all, but that was one of these slightly surreal things about working at Facebook. I think if you worked at Facebook, they were more likely to put you in kind of like random A/B tests.
Oh, it was god awful. It was an unusable app.
So you'd wake up sometimes and open Facebook and you'd be like, why am I only getting like health groups for like the 100th first post? You'd be like, oh, god darn it. Anyway.
I guess it's kind of like that. Yeah, for sure. You mentioned monitoring though. I think one thing that you wanted to talk about was the difference between investigations and monitoring.
This is going to get a little, this is something I've been kind of thinking about just in some of my conversations, especially in Europe, as regulators begin to think about like mandating certain types of transparency is, you know, my overall, where I have gotten to is that there's no single mechanism that will like make a platform transparent or not. So it is not simply about providing access to academically affiliated researchers. Yeah. It's not simply about producing quarterly reports with all of your takedown rates and yada, yada, that in the improv school of thought, this is a like yes and approach where we need as many, a lot of these different mechanisms that each kind of serve slightly different purposes and audiences and each have their own like value they bring. But I think one kind of heuristic I've been thinking about is the difference between investigations where you want to allow academics or researchers to be able to do kind of like longitudinal deep dives into a topic with like lots of data, ideally even like, I don't know, randomized control trials or whatever, but like deep investigations, which are by definition almost always going to be like longer and slower. And if you plug them into like the academic like journal cycle, then it's even like, it's like years, let alone also doing funding. It's not a fast process in the current kind of academic industry. The second one was like, you're like in monitoring, which is if you are like 2 weeks out from a national election, what is happening on a platform? Are prominent figures beginning to like question the legitimacy of, you know, the voting process? Is false information about where and when to register to vote or how to vote being spread? Is there incitement to violence happening in certain communities in the lead up to like a prominent national holiday? Like, I think of it more of those real time public interest topics aren't well served by doing like investigative lookbacks that inevitably take a year or two or longer to come to light. And so what we need is both. And I just want to be like very clear that when you do the long-term investigations, I think they're incredibly valuable and important. But I also think these platforms are changing so quickly that there's going to be things at which they're not going to be able to help with. And sometimes it might even be, how are the platforms currently designed? Because it might be that like groups are no longer a major priority, or like TikTok has added this or that. And so I think I've just been really trying to press that you need both investigative mechanisms, but you also need monitoring ones because of how fast some of these issues come and go on the platforms. And we want some ability for the public to also see them as they're happening, not just look back several years later.
Yeah. So what I think a good analogy to this is when you're inside an integrity team is you have your top line metrics at all points. You can always like update it daily, week over week, month over month. And you have your ops and escalation team too. And these have to exist in parallel. And there's no way around it.
Yeah. And in the nature of these platforms is such that like, you need both. And each are both going to be able to deliver different things. But if we end up just with like the look back, I think we'll miss a big opportunity and we'll struggle with a lot of issues that we've all been frustrated about until we figure out a way to make monitoring more required.
For sure. I think just one question I wanted to ask more from a personal standpoint, what like was the org structure behind CrowdTangle? Like you said, it was horizontal, but who did you report to? Because what I'm hearing a lot from your end is generally stakeholders were very aligned with what you guys were working on. And that wasn't the exact same experience I had, because I was in like a silo. I was in a product where I was always the Debbie Downer. So I'm just trying to understand is where in the org chart were you was CrowdTangle? And on my end, I was on product team, right? So I was the integrity part of our product team. And that really changed the experience between that I had and maybe the civic integrity
I
had.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so when we were acquired, we joined the partnerships team. So that is just, some folks will know what that means, some folks won't, but it's essentially under the business part of the company. And importantly, it's not under product. And so, I mean, I 100% think that had a lot of like pluses and minuses for our whole story and experience. On the plus side, our whole goal was to serve our partners, period. And that was like baked into what the goal of the partnership team was. And so we were able, you know, for a long time, our top line metric on our team is what's called NPS, which is something called Net Promoter Score. And it's basically a way to measure the sentiment of your partners.
Oh, nice.
So, okay. Like, literally our goal was to make our partners as happy as possible.
That's so great.
It was great. And we were good at it. And it's easy to be good at it when like also that's your only goal. Now
did you roll up to another metric? Because we had like the two standard ones, which was recall and precision, but eventually it would roll up to meaningful marketplace interaction.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to put this gently. Partnerships always struggled to figure out like how to quantify their work, just to be super blunt about it. Like, it was not as clear as being on product, where it was like, yes, we want to like increase time spent by 0.2% this quarter. Or partnerships was always a challenge. It was a lot more like poetry than science. And in fact, I think in some ways, like, we quantified things better than some other teams, and it was kind of notorious for every half. Metrics would change and yada yada. And maybe the best case to put it, they would try to roll up to product priorities, but just have like, it was very unclear what levers they were pulling actually moved those very much. So I think, one, in general, we were in a less metrics focused org. We were actually pretty good. But, you know, I also don't want it to make it sound like that then meant we could go do whatever the fuck we wanted. I think I was always super, super conscious of like making sure that leadership was always really happy with our team. And I know that sounds ridiculous given some of the ending, but like, emphasized like communication with leadership, making sure they knew what we're doing, what we're thinking. So I think somebody could have used that dynamic in a way where it's like very self-serving and just in the shit they believe in, et cetera. I wanted our team to like be a long-term part of the company. And I also, you know, just personally, there were a couple of people who like led our acquisition, and I wanted to make sure that like the company thought they made the right decision. And, you know,
yeah, for sure.
So, you know, it was not, I think people could have used that freedom to really, abuse it, but I tried really hard to make sure that we were very aligned with where the company was going and what they wanted. And again, I know it sounds ridiculous, but I've tried. That was really important to me. Now, I think the biggest challenge we ran into is at some point we were going to move over to product, which I think is like not an unreasonable move at all. I think I probably could argue for why partnerships are still better. They move over to product, but there was just nobody. There was no product leader where our work fit into what they did. And what ended up happening is like somebody raised their hand to take us, but didn't actually want us to do what we were doing. But I think, and this is up for some debate, you know, when we do an oral history in 20 years, somebody hopefully will maybe shed the light,
oral history of what? Yeah, of CrowdTangle?
CrowdTangle. You know, I think it's unclear how, I think, explicit it was that where we were going, we were not going to keep doing what we were doing.
I mean, yeah, I was about to ask, like, you want to deep dive on that, but I'll.
So I like you. We were under an instruction to move our product, which I think there would have been a lot of pluses for us doing that, but there was just no product leader that wanted us at the time. And by the time we did find a home, it was not one where they like wanted us to keep doing our work at all.
Gotcha.
But I'm not sure how clear that was made to the higher ups once that final decision was made.
I see. So I think there's a couple of things.
That's a lot of internal politics. I don't know how interesting it is.
I mean, internal politics is super fascinating. Like, what sells on TV, Succession, is all internal politics, right?
Yes, it's entertaining. I'm not sure how, like, yeah. Yeah, I go back and forth on whether how useful and interesting it is. And I understand it actually in some cases.
I mean, I think it's super helpful, right? Like, I was just about to ask you what are good tips and tricks of working with leadership. I think you obviously did a great job working with leadership for CrowdTangle. I think our listeners would they would find it very insightful, because trust and safety is always under scrutiny, right? Integrity is always under scrutiny. Transparency is always under scrutiny. How are you aligning the moral psychology of the stakeholders to the business interest, right? Or even when it's juxtaposed, like, how are you doing that? Does it like, concretely, what does it look like? Like, does it look like, are you talking to everyone, establishing, it can just be generic advice, like establishing a relationship with all the stakeholders beforehand. But is there any specific ways you would navigate it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a case to be made. I'm not good at it. I think we got a lot of resources and support for our work for 4 years. And I think that was a function of making sure the work we're doing was aligned and people believed in it and cared about it. And so I think, despite the kind of like snarky version of the story, I actually do think we did a good job of like getting leadership buy-in and support for a lot of the time we were there. I think, you know, my lessons, I think one of the challenges was that for a while we had a single, I could point to at least one champion who felt like the owner of the work we did. But when we changed our mission to transparency, we went from having a single champion to a diverse group of advocates.
A corporate champion.
Yeah. Yeah, a corporate champion. No, somebody who's willing, somebody who was in M Team, somebody who was like, when Mark wanted to review something, would be in the room and could stand up and say, this is why they're doing X, and this is the discussion we had, and I know it's doing this cost, but it's on me, you know. And we had that for a while, but when we switched to transparency, we went from having a single person without ownership to kind of a heterogeneous group that all like supported us, but I think no single person who felt like our owner and single champion anymore. And then when I think things got, you know, when there got some debates about our future, I think there was nobody willing to like put anything on the line for us. And so, I think that was one of the dynamics. And so I think make sure you have your champions and not your fans, not your advocates, not the people who support you, but somebody who will put something on the line and take, you know.
Do you have done that differently?
I mean, here's also part of the story though. It's like, and I don't want to say this to like let anyone off the hook. Well, I'll say a couple of things. I mean, first is like on a lot of these very high level decisions of the company, it is my experience was that often the case there is some division among leadership. And, you know, when it came to our work and transparency, I think there was too. Now, oftentimes some of that leadership ends up just deferring to whatever Mark wants at the end of the day. He's head of the company, et cetera. But oftentimes if it's like one level down, there tends to be like some differing of opinions. So it's not always monolithic. But then secondly is like, you know, the world was changing very dramatically between like 2017 and 2020. And, you know, I think Facebook is moving away entirely from everything they're doing in news. So like the original vision for what we were supposed to do at the company is almost would be like moot at this point.
Right.
You know, it wouldn't even like fall anywhere in any, doesn't matter how long the list of priorities are, it wouldn't like make the cut. And then when it came to transparency, I think like, you know, there were a lot of complicating external factors to it, including there were some platforms that weren't doing anything and seemed to be getting away entirely with that. And so there were certainly some voices who like looked at us and were like, why are we getting hit over the head like every day when like we could just not be doing anything and like not be suffering, you know, and then, you know, get away with it. And I also think there was increasingly a specter of regulation. And when regulation is coming, I think one of the things that happens is you go into this kind of like pre-regulatory like fog or like paralysis, where I think instead of investing in anything related to these issues, you are simply trying to like prepare for what the requirements are going to be. And I think we were getting into the beginning of like the pre-regulatory fall where it's like, hey, we're done like voluntarily trying to like make the external world feel better about what we're doing in X. Instead, we're just going to wait for them to tell us what to do. And I think like by 2020, they were like beginning to like wind down some of these things. And because they knew some regulation was going to come and just tell them what to do. But yeah, all that being said, I think there were a lot of people at the company who believed in transparency, who supported what we did, but some of whom weren't. But we weren't able to get the right voices in the room when it mattered the most.
Got it. First off, thanks for being a guest. Thanks for your detailed responses. I'm sure this will be one of the classic episodes we play at some point in the future. but I know you're also working with the EU right now. What's going on there? And tell us more about the demand for technical experts.
Yeah, I mean, I given the audience of this podcast, I think one of the things that I thought about immediately when you reached out and invited me, which I was very excited about, is I was in Brussels. I've been in Brussels a couple of times this year. I just got back a couple of weeks ago. They are trying to build out the Digital Services Act, which is this sweeping piece of regulation, especially for social media. And there's a lot of work around transparency, but also risk assessments, trust and safety, integrity more broadly. And this law is passed. It's formalized. It's been approved by all 27 members of the European Union, and they are now in implementation mode. And they're starting to get into the weeds of what this work actually looks like. And there is just a huge gap in the amount of technical expertise that exists in I mean, to be honest, in the world, but also especially in Europe, as they get really into the details of what does it mean to do an algorithmic like audit or to do a transparency report focused on X or Y, and or how do we compare them, and how do we even know if they're meeting their requirements, or how do we know if what they told us is the right metric? Is that a reasonable metric? Like, and I'll give you a really concrete example. One of the very first things they had to do was report out their monthly average uniques. So they had to tell the commission, a bunch of the platforms had to tell the commission how big they are.
Oh, I see.
If they're, okay. If they're above a certain size, they officially get delegated as a very large online platform. There were some monthly average uniques where some people in the commission and some of the people looking at stuff were like, that doesn't sound exactly right. Like, I'm curious how they defined it and, you know, why it seems smaller than the one they reported in this other space like 6 months ago. And they said, no, but there's a gap of technical expertise on the commission to be able to say, hey, like these three seem a little like fishy. Just, you know, fishy. Yeah. We would ask for like some more details on how do they calculate it. And then having somebody who knows what they're talking about be able to look at the calculations and say, okay, no, those are the right ones. And, or no, those are like, you can't use that or X or Y. So there's just there's a huge gap. And I would say, so, I mean, I kind of say this slightly kind of tongue in cheek, but I also kind of mean it, is if you're in the trust and safety and integrity space and you've like ever wanted to live in Europe, you could essentially like pick the capital you'd like to live in. And, you know, obviously you got to figure out immigration stuff, which varies in different places, but there's just they're going to be building out agencies that focus on social media internet regulation in all 27 member states. They're hiring things called digital service coordinators. The European Union is building out its own set of teams, and they're all going to be focused on, I think, a lot of the issues that, like, if you were in trust and safety, you care about and have some expertise in, and they're just going to need a lot of help. And so there's just a huge demand on trying to build out this regulatory muscle in Europe right now. And I think it's a really fascinating opportunity to be like at the front, like on the ground in helping think through some of these things. Because honestly, I think a lot of these questions are nobody's asked and quite figured out how to do. And so I think it was like a fascinating opportunity, but also just a big one. Now, there are some downsides. It is, you know, you're not going to get Silicon Valley pay, but, you know, maybe you get to live in Seville, Spain for 2 years, and that's, you know, you can... you net out probably higher than if you were getting a Silicon Valley salary and living in Bay Area. So,
yeah, for sure. I think, there's definitely someone in the audience or some people in the audience will definitely be interested. And where can they reach out to you?
Yeah, easiest is always just email me at brandon.silverman@gmail.com. I'm on LinkedIn as well. I started a Substack recently called Some Good Trouble. Yeah, I think those are probably the best places.
I actually am curious, how are they fudging the numbers for monthly active uniques?
Well, so I think there's a couple. So some of the discussions I had with some people I know, there's some questions around, and some of them you have to do it based on surface.
Oh,
and so
right.
Like, it might be that you say like, sorry, our group's surface only has X, but this doesn't have Y. But then are you counting group interactions that happened in the main feed versus like in the groups tab? I saw one version of like the surface versus if a part of that surface shows up somewhere else, what gets counted. And yeah, I'm trying to remember. But I think that was, and there were a few that came in low. I think like Telegram came in surprisingly low or something.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I think Twitter, they just had like no idea if anybody was even around to like count them and to what degree are they updating their bot numbers versus not, you know, because Twitter used to, despite Elon's protestations, Twitter had a fairly accepted industry standard for trying to calculate, you know, monetizable, what they considered like actual humans the platform versus just everybody. And so is the new Twitter number, you know, is that them subtracting what they, you know, 60% of accounts because they're claiming those are all bots or, you know, so.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah. Cool. Any closing thoughts?
No, other than like, you know, I do think, yeah, I love the podcast, and I think I'm actually bullish on this entire space.
Is there room for social entrepreneurs, right? CrowdTangle started as a social entrepreneurship angle. And what what would you say? You're bullish on this space. So what does that mean for a social entrepreneur that doesn't necessarily want to work for an agency?
Yeah, no. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I mean, I think there's going to be, I think this is a like thousand flowers blooming moment in the space where you're going to see both like regulatory opportunities. There's going to be nonprofit social entrepreneurship opportunities. There's going to be for-profit social entrepreneurship opportunities. Like I have at least several friends that are trying to build like dedicated trust and safety tools and businesses that are for-profit. And the idea is that how can we take the expertise that we built and provide it to platforms in a way where they don't have to constantly be hiring and building out these domains and functions entirely on their own. I think we have gone through a like come to Jesus public like awakening around that we need this trust and safety integrity needs to be a core muscle in the internet, and it should flow through all the different, you know, the different parts of the internet, from the private platforms themselves to the regulatory bodies to nonprofits, civil society. And so I think the next couple of years, what we're going to see is the proliferation of like technical expertise beginning to like make its way into our understanding of the issue.
Gotcha.
And then I think hopefully once we get past that, we'll start to see the technical expertise both be able to like address these issues better, at which point then I think we'll probably, hopefully, I think then be able to have like a more robust debate about the value trade-offs. But right now, the technical expertise has been so lacking that people have just either been doing it themselves or not doing it at all.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate your time on the podcast. We had a one and a half hour conversation. So yeah. If the listener made it this far, I made it this far, Brandon made it this far. So again, thank you for coming onto the show.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
If you enjoyed today's conversation, please share this episode to your friends so we can continue making episodes like this. Today's episode was produced by me, Talha Baig. Music by Zhao Shen. And special thanks to Sahar, Cass, Rachel, and Sean for their continued support.